Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
It was almost like Alice in Wonderland kind of territory in terms of the sheer psychedelic nature of how that money was being wasted.
Welcome all to episode 45 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guests, plural, are Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan. Mark and Paul are the authors of Champagne Football, John Delaney and The Betrayal of Irish Football, The Inside Story, which builds on the pair's award-winning series of stories for the Sunday Times last year, which laid bare in lurid detail the sickening excess and the extraordinary financial mismanagement of the FAI during the tenure of former CEO John Delaney. The book is an exceptional piece of reporting that will ask you to scoop your jaw off the floor multiple times, and it is available now. Just before we get to the chat, a reminder to get in touch with us. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. But now let's get to our conversation with the authors of Champagne Football, Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan. Mark and Paul, thanks so much for doing the show. We really appreciate it. It is a hell of a book that you've written. Champagne Football, John Delaney and the Betrayal of Irish Football, The Inside Story. Paul, I might start with you, and you might set the scene for us by explaining why you use the word betrayal in the title.
I suppose Delaney was kind of portrayed as the kind of white knight that was going to drive the Football Association of Ireland into the modern era, get rid of the antiquated ways that the old FAI used to work under. You know, he was a reformer. He was a kind of an innovator. All the things that he would have put down in his pamphlet when he went for the UEFA Executive Committee job, a visionary, a man of vision. And unfortunately, that vision, whatever it turned into, drove Irish football to the wall, bankrupted it virtually, and at huge cost to a lot of people and to Irish football as a whole. So that's why it was a betrayal.
Irish football is probably going to be forever in financial debt, but I think, to be fair, it will be in a debt to you both because for your work on this book. It all began really, Mark, in March 2019 when you wrote that first story about the unexplained €100,000 loan that John Delaney gave to the FAI. It resulted in a fairly dramatic standoff in the forecourts on St. Patrick's weekend. It's told really well in the book. Can you maybe set the scene for our listeners and just recount that tale if you're not sick of telling it already?
Yeah, sure. I suppose like Paul had been covering the FAI and its corporate governance issues and, the mad stuff that Delaney had been getting up to and the financial issues blighting the FAI. And I'd been tying along, trying to do some stories like that as well, covering Delaney's personal finances. And then next thing I get this tip off landing on my desk, literally through the post, basically with two photocopies, one of a personal check from John Delaney of €100,000 from his Bank of Ireland account in Waterford going into the FAI in Blanchardstown. And then the other document was a remittance payment showing €100,000 going to the from the FAI into John Delaney. And so straight away, I got on to Cathal Durbin, who had just started as the FAI's press officer, but was kind of finishing off in the Irish Sun at the time. He was their sports editor. And, he was saying, there's no story here. John Delaney's solicitor called him that night. It's kind of similar story, that, saying there's no story here and alluding to a family law case that this is where the document must have leaked from. And thankfully, I emailed the FAI as well, the press office, and that was a very important thing because 2 weeks on, when we were happy that the story was 100% genuine, that we'd been able to back it up through other sources. Next thing, at the last minute on the Saturday, the eve of St. Patrick's Day, just before we're going to go to print, John Delaney went to the forecourts and into the High Court, saw an injunction, effectively a super injunction, that this is all from family law case, was covered by the in-camera rule and we were breaching his rights of privacy. He was suing me and Sunday Times, and he wanted to injunct the story. And we had quite a fraught court hearing, really heated. Great legal work from Hugh Hannigan, the Times in-house legal manager, and our barrister on the night. Was fantastic. It convinced the judge, you know, that John Delaney had delayed for 2 weeks. You know, why this last that ditch tackle? And also, you know, there's no proof that we'd got any of this from a family law case. And the judge said, yeah, significant public interest in any kind of transaction that we, like the one we were outlining between the FAI, an organization that got 50 million euro at that stage over the last 10 years from the state. And, you know, any transaction between the FAI and its chief executive of the nature that we were talking about was a matter of significant public interest. So off you go, guys. And John Delaney, you have to pay the Sunday Times costs. So a huge relief, you know, and great kudos to Frank Fitzgibbon for agreeing to go to war on that. And, you know, high risk moment, you know, because we could have been landed with 50 grand worth of legal costs ourselves.
And Mark, did you, when you pulled at that thread, did you expect everything to unspool from there?
No, like, we'd no idea how quickly things would escalate over the following weeks. You know, like, John Delaney, from an external point of view, you know, was well cemented in his position. You know, he'd helped secure the you know, Ireland getting four games in Euro 2020. There's talk about Ireland being in a World Cup bid with England and the other home nations. You know, he's on the UEFA Exco. He was going from strength to strength. There was no idea that it would all suddenly come crumbling down. What we did suspect straight away was, like, Jesus, this is the first time there's been a breach in this facade, this you know, wall that John Lennon had erected around the FAI's finances, and that everything was okay. We suspected, well, this is quite serious. We're quite sure what we had, to be honest. We suspected that there was a possible breach of company law, and that it hadn't been declared in the publicly filed accounts, the audited accounts from Deloitte, and that, you know, everyone knows that directors' loans, even if they're repaid in a short amount of time, they should be declared for transparency's sake and under company law. That's, you'd expect that to be the case. So we thought it could be the first chink in something a lot bigger, but we'd no idea how quickly it would escalate and what would actually we'd further uncover then.
Mm. And the impression across those few weeks in March and April, when you were, it was kind of a death by a thousand cuts, you had so many damaging stories, both of you, in the Sunday Times. The fact that the FAI had been covering his rent for a couple of years, and then you had his credit card bills, which is probably the final nail in the coffin. My impression was that, and I think everyone's impression was, you had all this stuff and you were feeding it out week by week for maximum effect. But Mark, as you say in the book, it wasn't that way. And it seems, from a journalistic point of view, especially after the Sunday Times had recorded a radio ad trumping up coverage, that you hadn't fully got over the line yet. It must have been...
It was much more fly-by-your-pants situation. Like, yeah, even FBI directors at the time were going, you know, you guys are just sitting on a big archive of stuff here and, you know, deliberately spooling this out. And they're like, it's far from the case, you know. Even the rent story, you know, until that Saturday... It still wasn't in the bag journalistically. You know, I still had a few issues I needed to make sure that I was correct. You know, that was a high risk story itself. You know, that we'd no documentation to base that on, but we'd two excellent sources that backed each other up and covered different periods. So, and I was, you know, I made up further calls then, you know, and to the Grand Yeshoigas, you know, it turned out to be the house we're living in. The FBI covered rent of up to 36,000 euro a year there on top of the salary. So no, it was much more fly by the seat of your pants. And yeah, it was only near the end actually that we did get some internal documents and the FBI credit card statements, you know, which were, as you say, we got them after Frank had approved the radio ad voiced by Tom Dunn, you know, bigging up our exclusives and coverage of this, of the unfolding crisis in the FAI. So the pressure was really on. And yeah, I'll never forget sitting in the Oireachtas hearing. It was so surreal. Like, I remember, like, John Delaney going out for a toilet break and Paul was sitting at the edge there, and Delaney goes, "Hiya, Paul." I was like, what is this guy like? And I just before that, I got a text message. My phone vibrated, and I got an encrypted message off of a deep throat source, re-establishing contact, someone who hadn't been in contact over a few weeks. And out of that, yeah, that came the kind of the treasure trove. Then, you know, just on that Friday, I got, as I say in the book, you know, in a car park outside a toy shop, I got John Delaney's credit card statements, which were, you know, bingo. Once I started going through them, I was like, oh my God, it's worse than I could have thought.
Yeah. You mentioned the Oireachtas hearing. The three of us were at it. It was kind of a day of high drama. The public interest in that day was insane. Like, as you mentioned in the book, there was 45,000 people watching Oireachtas TV. Like, it's they're
just
kind
on
of
the streaming, yeah, just on their laptops or phones. And more, I couldn't get the figures from the Oireachtas TV. They don't keep them, so I'm sure there was more people tuned in on Virgin Media or wherever they get that channel. Yeah, so like it was like the equivalent, at least, of the Aviva Stadium being full, you know, and there was running commentary from people, and clips were going up straight away as well. Like when Eddie Murray made the famous faux pas about only having one bank account when there was at least 24, you know, that clip was, people were like, it was almost like a highlights package, you know, someone had the clip up straight away. And I remember like a couple of the papers the next day were doing player analysis and giving rankings for, you know, the FAI team and the politicians who'd done well or who was good up front. And it was high stakes, and there was micro analysis of it. So I think it was the most watched thing. I think only was there one other thing that was more watched that year in the whole Oireachtas coverage, maybe around the budget or something, like, so, which affects the whole nation, you know. It just shows you, like, yeah, the story was massive, you know, and the fact that John Delaney was, for the first, after weeks and weeks in pressure, it was the first time people were expecting to hear from John Delaney. And no one expected, and not even the FAI expected, as we detail in the book, you know, that actually John's tactic would be to park the bus and say nothing.
Yeah, I remember one of the play ratings was John Delaney not on long enough to be rated. I kicked myself over. Paul, was that the day that public opinion firmly shifted against Delaney?
Well, I think part of the interest was, as Mark said, there'd be this incredible build-up. There'd been a sequence of revelations in our newspaper, particularly one or two in the Sun as well. But I mean, even before that, you know, Delaney had become a bit of a kind of a national celebrity. You know, he had kind of established his profile for himself as, you know, not just a football administrator, but a kind of a, you know, a person on the scene. You know, he'd obviously had a, you know, been on you know, various kind of Strictly Come Dancing type events. And you know, he'd been on the cover of the Living section of the Sunday Independent on a couple of occasions, or the magazine section of the Sunday Independent. So he developed a kind of a profile for himself outside of football, and that sort of contributed to the interest. My personal opinion was that I thought that Delaney was finished long before that, because of all the, you know, there was no coming back from some of the things that had already emerged. For instance, you know, even the day the story came out in the Sunday Times on St. Patrick's Day, and the following day, they were continually asserting that the board had known all the time that about the 100 grand loan that had been made, when in fact only, you know, two or three members of the board knew. So that, to me, was clearly misleading. And I felt from that point that really Delaney perhaps should have been sacked at that point, you know, by the FAI, because it was clearly getting out of control. But rather than doing that, they continued to kind of try to almost cover up for him for what had happened. And even in the game against Gibraltar, which I don't know if you were at that one, Gavin, as well, you know, there was crazy scenes in the hotel where they're trying to write out a new contract for him as executive vice president on the sort of, you know, in handwritten contract written out by the president, Donal Conway, who seems to be bending over backwards to accommodate what John Delaney wants, even though there had been all these quite lurid revelations, really, in one way, in the newspapers. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose there was a huge backlash after that Oireachtas hearing. You know, it was felt that the politicians hadn't really nailed Delaney in the first half of that hearing, but that things unfolded, as Mark said, particularly when Eddie Murray kind of couldn't remember how many bank accounts the FAI had, and then it became a kind of a, there wasn't so much questions as kind of just condemnation from the politicians. I think is it a Melda Munster? Is it Sinn Féin? TD, she was sort of, she excoriated Delaney and Jonathan O'Brien likewise. And I think they kind of caught the kind of national mood, that people were really tired of this charade. And also the kind of fact that, that Delaney had thought himself basically untouchable and had come to the Oireachtas with a sort of a top sort of legal team and had chosen to plead the Fifth Amendment, you know, effectively. So it went down really badly. And I think it also turned the rest of the board against him as well, for sure.
Mm. And also the amazing scene in the book after the Oireachtas hearing, he thought it went well. If, what planet is this guy living on?
Well, that's exactly what Donald Conway said. Yeah, Delaney was happy. Yeah, he was in. There's several times, you know, where he thought with one leap he was free. Like one was Gibraltar when he moved to executive vice president, where everyone else was going, this is bizarre. Like even the title executive vice president, you know, people were, you know, it was a Simpsons meme, and you know, the fact that he'd be this in this position and he wouldn't be answerable to the new chief executive, whoever that would be. It was such a bonkers move by the FAI board to agree to such a move. You know, something like this Jonathan Hall thing was such a facade, you know, that concocted by Delaney, designed by Delaney, you know, with the end result already given to the consultant that did the report, an awful joke of a report. And yeah, but I remember people saying, you know, John going out to Gibraltar was fretting. He wasn't himself. He was all over the place. And then on the flight back after that huge eulogy of the statement issued, you know, that John was, you know, light as a feather. He was bubbly. He was back to his old self. He thought he was free. And again, yeah, a month on at the Oireachtas hearing again, you know, when they retreated to Buswell's for coffee and pints, John was in great mood. You know, he thought that was fantastic, you know. And as we say in the book, like Donald Conway was just really struggling to understand what with what reality or what version of reality was John Delaney in at that stage.
Mm, it took the suspension of state funding and like an entire country's condemnation, but the board did eventually turn against Delaney, and you detail obviously very well how they eventually got him out of there with a payment. Well, it was September, I think, by the time he officially left with a payment of $462,000.
Our Susan Keegan story kind of put the kibosh on the first attempt to have a payoff and a deal. Yeah, so John Delaney got another 6 months off his $360,000 a year salary until the new board came in and decided with, like they had a negotiator, a solicitor go in on their behalf and negotiate nearly the same deal they had done 6 months previously.
Mm. I think also the story about his golden handcuffs deal just sort of angered the board. You know, again, it was something that they didn't really know about. You know, it was already sort of, it had been sort of made back in 2014, and it effectively, you know, must have doubled Delaney's salary. We were already sort of angered and aghast at how much he was being paid. And then there was all these benefits in kind and pension payments and deals on whether he would have, you know, when and how he would have left the association, which effectively were, I think it was about €3 million, wasn't it, Mark, in extra money that was coming his way, which nobody knew about. And I think
Michael Cody kept the contract in his house. Another bizarre thing we uncover.
Yeah, and I think Conway, Donald Conway in particular, was after he had bent over backwards to sort of defend his chief executive, I think he felt betrayed when that came out. And I think the penny dropped then for Donald Conway, who some people, you know, think is a kind of a fair man, really. And a lot of people respect him for his decency. But I think at that stage he realized he'd been duped, and that it was all too much for him and too big for him, really. But he was also angry, and it was at that point that I think Delaney as well was on the way out.
Like plenty of people want to know how Delaney became untouchable, and it's explained in the book basically, and we don't have enough time probably to cover that. But I do want to focus for a few minutes on the attitude to the media within the FAI, because there was a terror of talking to the media instilled from above. Like you mentioned the fact, Mark, that Michael Cody had the contract hidden away at his house. I mean, Niamh O'Donoghue, at one point, a board member in the book, wants reports to be given to the board a few days in advance of meetings rather than being put in front of them immediately. And the reason given why they have to be given immediately is because they'd be afraid of leaking to the media. Like, it definitely felt to me that the terror of leaking to the media was used as a kind of an excuse to keep things obfuscated at times.
Entirely, yeah. Like Delaney had this overriding instruction that, you know, keep things secret. You know, he talked even about, you know, let's get rid of the finance committee, which is, an oversight committee, because we don't actually give them much information anyway because it's so sensitive, you know, and we know not maybe now why he wanted to keep all the finance details to himself, because there was so much carry on there and the FAI's financial situation was so bad. This is something that was going on continuously in the FAI through the years. The media really was the enemy, you know, and it was one of the shocking moments when we were doing the interviews. One director said to me that, you know, I'm glad I didn't know about this 3 million golden handcuffs deal, because I couldn't be accused of leaking it then, you know. And you're like, come on, like you have a corporate and legal responsibility to know what's happening with the FAI's finances, but that's what you're concerned about, you know, John having a go at you for leaking. So yeah, like the FAI board was not run properly. Like they were handed these 30-page chief executive reports at every monthly meeting, you know, where John would talk about everyone he'd gone to lunch with, all the clubs he'd visited, maybe 30 clubs he'd visited in the month or more, you know, 5 or 6 each weekend. And there was a lot of detail there, but it was on stuff that the board didn't really need to know about, you know, like how the under-21s were doing and so on. And there usually would be one paragraph on the FAI's finances that things are tight and it's being managed, you know, and that was kind of the amount of detail he was giving the board. But that means when you're a board member, when you see something like that, you should be going, hang on a sec, what's actually happening here? What's happening with the finance? Where is the detailed financial report?
Yeah,
I think the secrecy thing kind of goes, he made a virtue out of it, because if, like, he came in after the, after the Genesis report in 2002 over the sort of mess up in Saipan, it was felt that the FAI was sort of a chaotic organization, you know, as I touched on before, and that it was too unwieldy, it was too large, and that there was too many self-interested groups who were leaking to the media. You know, it was a very leaky organization. But I think that, you know, over the previous, like Bernard O'Byrne found when he was trying to get the Aircom Park Stadium up and running, that, you know, there was people leaving board meetings and going and doing media interviews about what had been discussed, and that I think Delaney was fingered as being one of the people who was doing those interviews. So he was a bit of a poacher turned gamekeeper in that respect, trying to sort of he knew what had happened before, and when he came in and they cut the board down to 10 and it became a far more kind of tighter kind of little cabal, really. Secrecy and confidentiality and lack of transparency almost became like a virtue, like a sign that we had changed, that we've actually reformed. Look, there are no more leaks. Look, the media aren't getting the stories. So in a way, as I say, he made a virtue out of that, but it did come back to sort of bite him in the end.
He was hostile to anyone from inside talking to the media outside, but he was also, Paul, hostile from anyone from the outside trying to get in to the inside. You worked this beat for years. I mean, how difficult was it as a journalist?
It was problematic. I mean, I think with stories coming up like the Vantage Club and you know, how that was sort of handled and the whole conception of that, it was so obviously a monumental error that, you know, I think everybody in the media realized that Delaney had made a massive mistake. And the board had made a massive mistake in bringing in these foreign guys to sell to set the pricing levels for the season tickets, and at that stage it kind of started to become a bit more open season against Delaney, particularly when he kind of tried to convince us all that no, everything was fine, that the tickets were selling, that the tickets were priced correctly. Instead, we had a situation where the FAI was getting deeper and deeper into debt and not being able to pay back the money. But there was a lot of kind of legal, you know, restraints on us. Delaney was very, very litigious. I would imagine he probably had some sort of case against your organization, as well as virtually every media organization in the country. You know, he So particularly over the Rio Games in 2016. No, I've got the date wrong there. I think
that's
it was
right. Yeah.
2016.
You're right, yeah.
2016. Yeah, where he took a number of legal actions because it was said that the Brazilian police were on his tail, and the media organizations paid up. So I think people were scared of him. RTE particularly. He was very, very litigious. In fact, as we've been going on doing some media interviews over the last few days, we've spoken to a couple of journalists who said, "Hey, yeah, it happened to me as well." And there was just so much of it going on. It was almost like litigation on an industrial scale, all paid for by the FAI. And as the one of the reports showed, Delaney was pocketing most of the settlements into his for himself.
That's, yeah, it's totally demoralizing to read something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but I'd heard the rumors. But to see it in black and white like that was kind of still shocking, you know.
And Paul, while you and a lot of the other soccer journalists are on this beat and hammering away at this story and trying to, you know, get to print whatever you can, there are some parts of the Irish media cozying up to John Delaney. Like when you see the John the Baptist documentary or the Life magazine or this stuff, does it not piss you off? Like,
I have to say it doesn't piss me off too much. I mean, because I don't know. I mean, I found it quite amusing on one level. I mean, I think, you know, Delaney, he is a bit of an entertainer in a way, and watching him go about his business is really quite fascinating. You know, it was quite fascinating, but you don't want to be get kind of caught too much in the headlights at the same time. But yeah, I mean, the Barry Egan, of course, was his great promoter, and made the John the Baptist documentary, which, you know, portrayed Delaney not as John the Baptist but as Jesus Christ, almost like so it was actually so ludicrous, it was actually funny. But yeah, it of course I found it more frustrating that the politicians really didn't do more to investigate what was going on at the FAI, or to make you know, to make the FAI more accountable for the public money that was coming its way. I mean, it really disturbs me when I read you know, Cozy saying that no public money was misdirected. You know, Cozy did the report for Sport Ireland, but you know, you've got so much misspending of money at the top level. Then the government coming in to shore up, you know, the grassroots. You know, that for me, that essentially is misspending. I mean, how can you pump money into an organization that's fundamentally, you know, corrupt in some ways? You know, to me, it's a very narrow definition of the word money wasn't misspent. Money was misspent by everybody. And I think the government, politicians of all parties, and also Sport Ireland, you know, eventually have to hold their hands up on this and say, you know, we took our eye off the ball here, seriously.
Yeah. We have the truth of the financial situation. The FAI eventually came out. They held a press conference, I think it was December last year, when they realised that there was €63 million in debt. I remember one of the directors left the room. It was very, very kind of hot and heavy atmosphere in the room. Left and puffed his cheeks out and said, just a shit show. I think that kind of summed it all up. But I know there was insane moments of extravagance and misspending throughout. But Mark, the fundamental issue at the heart of this was the Vantage Club scheme, wasn't it? The fact that they way overpriced the premium tickets that they needed to sell to pay for their share of the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, that was a deal with the IRFU. One senior FAI person said to me, it was just, you know, he said the IRFU must be laughing into their sleeve continuously over this deal with the FAI. The FAI pick up half the building costs, half the running costs every year. That's about 2.6 million has to go into the Aviva Stadium from each organization to keep it running each year. And, you know, whenever the FAI were in trouble, actually, the first person that would stop getting paid would be the stadium, you know, and they said it was embarrassing, but this happened continuously. So you had the stadium continuously looking for the money off their shareholder, the FAI. So it was just a bad deal from the start. And if you look, every single match the IRFU would nearly sell out. and the corporate section would be, you know, they'd almost sell out as well, or continuously sell out, and the FAI just couldn't match that, partly because just the football was so bad, and, you know, Delaney's way of addressing that was, you know, paying huge money to people like Giovanni Trapattoni or Martin O'Neill, you know, kind of quick fix, while the fundamentals were rotten in the League of Ireland and elsewhere. So, yeah, it was a constant bleed on the organisation's finances. And what was happening was Delaney wouldn't admit it was wrong, or it was going bad, or it was continuing to be bad, and he would suck in the money from sponsorship, and mainly from UEFA and the TV deals, future revenue streams, you know, basically robbing the FAI's future, saying we need that money now to address cash flow or to pay off the stadium. So, like, you know, as we detail in the book, like FIFA grants coming in should be going spreading around the football, but it was all going into the stadium, you know, instead of going to the grassroots. So while, you know, Delaney was like Jesus, as John would say, and a director said that to me, it was like Jesus going to Jerusalem when he went to a club visit, getting lauded when he went to give out $5,000 in checks or $10,000 in checks and match tickets and jerseys to the clubs. He was actually starving grassroots football of the investment it needed and the proper structures and reforms it needed. But securing his position, and, you know, people were lauding him at AGMs.
And why didn't he just admit in, say, 2012 that, okay, we've made a mistake here? Because it took years. I think it was 2018 by the time he admitted we were given bad advice, and he still didn't take responsibility for it.
Yeah, that was one thing with Delaney. He'd never admit when he was wrong, you know, and go to the whole back to the secrecy thing, you know, he didn't. I suppose if he admitted things were bad, people started asking more and more questions. And I think that's, going back to March 2019, that was why he was so concerned about our story, the first story, and why he went to the High Court. It's such kind of a big risk to take, that he didn't want people looking under the bonnet, because not only were the FAI's finances rotten, but John had his money and had his hand in the till as well, in terms of, you know, on top of his 360 a year salary, you know, he was getting the rent payments when he shouldn't have been. He was abusing his FAI credit card. He was taking advantage of the legal situation, getting A&L Goodbody to take cases for him and pocketing the money, getting involved in all sorts of crazy deals, like the Con Martin Jr. deal, where suddenly, you know, the FAI paid out over €500,000 for a concept of sponsored walk and the John Giles Foundation. And that's just probably one of the worst, but among a series of crazy deals and transactions that the FAI got into under John Delaney.
Mm. Paul, is there any specifically bad transaction and mess that Delaney and the FAI got into that sticks out in your mind?
Well, it kind of touches on what Mark was just saying. Some of the payoffs to kind of staff who are leaving, you know, the association. You know, it When Frank had the bravery to challenge that injunction in 2019, like he was one of the few people to kind of almost like call Delaney's bluff when it came to getting Delaney into court, because that was never a place that Delaney really wanted to end up. You know, he would normally settle, or he would normally make sure that people were silenced by just throwing money at them, really. I mean, you know, you look at the settlement that Fran Rooney got when he, left the job as chief executive back in 2004, 2005. You know, it was like 2 years' salary. It was as Fran told us,
Euro.
it was in the region of 500,000 to 600,000 euro. Yeah, and just throwing money at things to make the problem go away. It continuously reared its head. Mark there refers to the John Giles Foundation and the sponsored walk. That was another €500,000. Really, most people would say entirely wasted for the idea of a sponsored walk. It was quite extraordinary. It was almost like Alice in Wonderland kind of territory in terms of the sheer psychedelic nature of how that money was being wasted. So that was really one of the things that struck me and explains that his answer to problems was to throw money at it and throw somebody else's money at it, i.e. The FAI's.
Paul, in the course of writing this book, did you come any closer to understanding what drove John Delaney?
Yeah, I think so. Just really, I think he was somebody who was desperate to be loved by everybody in some ways. He wanted to be loved and admired by the grassroots. Then he wanted to be the same from the fans. Then he, as I said, he became a bit of a national celebrity. So he seemed to have a great desire to be loved by everybody. I suppose one of the theories going around is, you know, was he trying to impress his father in some ways? Was has often been kind of a theory that we'll maybe never know the definitive answer to. You know, his father was a very gregarious kind of character, kind of described is a gregarious character, but he's kind of described as kind of like an almost like an Arthur Daly figure, but was actually really well liked as an individual by a lot of people in the Football Association of Ireland. Before he left the association in 1996, and John really kind of came in his place from then, and one got always got the sense that Joe was quite a powerful figure in the background, and not just in terms of his advice, but his personality, and that maybe John was driven by a desire in some ways to pick up his father's legacy, and also to sort of impress his father by exceeding what his father had done in many ways in terms of the amount of power that he enjoyed in the association. So, so that's again, unless, you know, John tells us, we may never know. I think Delaney himself has kind of hinted at kind of, you know, having kind of issues, you know, down the years. Like I think he talked on the Brendan O'Connor show of being in a dark place, you know, so, you know, we know through the court action that he obviously had he was separated, divorced from his wife, etc. But there's a loss, and we know as well about we saw the way he behaved in Sopot, like where he was clearly kind of intoxicated and really looked to be out of control in some ways. The guy does have issues. So on top of the fact that, but he would say that he. I think at one stage he said that he loved the association too much. Is that right, Mark? I think at one point there was a remark at the board that, you know, I almost loved the association too much, which was a strange thing to say in the light of what was coming out at the time. And what we know now was that I think he loved himself in the end a lot more than he loved the association.
Mm. We have a couple of quick listener questions before we wrap, guys. I know, Paul, you've got plenty of other important work to get to. A listener called Aidan Delaney, who we assume is no relation, but to be fair, he hasn't clarified it for us, wants to ask each of you, if you were to have a themed birthday party, what would the theme be? Can we rule out James Bond?
No, I want a James Bond. Who's James Bond? I want a Q. I'll have a Q-themed birthday party, put it that way.
I'm partial to James Bond myself. You know, something me and John Delaney have in common.
Altogether more prosaically, a couple of people wanted to ask, did you have any contact with John for the book, and have there been any legal issues raised from that end?
Thankfully, no legal issues whatsoever, touch wood. We did try John Delaney on numerous occasions, but he hasn't responded. His solicitor, Aidan Eames, emailed to say, please do not contact us again, as we will not be responding. And that was it. And Paul had a brief conversation with Joe Delaney.
A brief conversation, brief being the word, Paul?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, we'd written about Joe and about, you know, what had happened when he left the association. So, in fairness to him, even though he is, you know, he's quite old at this time in his life. In fairness, we did put a quick call into him. I think he was watching the racing. You know, he was defiant, and again, kind of it seemed to be all the media's fault. I mean, I think he called us scumbags, and kind of yellow pack press, and kind of really left me with a bit of a flea in my ear. It has to be said, you know, because. He kind of said, don't call back, and we respected that, but he obviously wanted to make the point that he felt that he essentially was saying that the Delaneys had been more wronged than wronging, seemed to have been his way of looking at it. And I think John Delaney might feel that way himself, but it may be that other people will make the ultimate decision on that.
That's with an eye to the future. Paul, I'll ask you as to what the future holds for the FAI. Are we heading for calm waters? Are you confident that the new regime can move on? We've heard a lot of about regime change and ultimately false stones at the FAI. Will this be another one?
I'd be a bit more positive than that, Gavin. Are we about to sort of hear who the new chief executive is?
Yeah.
Apparently it's Jonathan Hill. By the time you go on air, that'll either be confirmed or knocked back. An outsider coming in from abroad, from England, as I understand it, no baggage, we hope, hopefully a guy who can sort of turn the association around financially. And obviously, I mean, it's been pretty turbulent since Delaney left. It's been extremely turbulent. And all those stories about leaks and everything else and splits and divides. And, you even hear some people saying it was better under Delaney, hopefully now if we assume it's Jonathan Hill, I don't know much about him, I have to say, as of yet. If he is a strong kind of, personality with integrity, that word integrity was in the job description, and he can unite that board and move it along. Yeah, I don't think we have to be caught in this continuous cycle of, disappointment, controversy, scandal. They've always become kind of bywords for Irish football, but I don't think they have to be for the next decade. I think the chairman, Roy Barrett, is a pretty competent guy, pretty sort of guy with some integrity. So, yeah, I would be a bit more positive than think it's going to be just like Groundhog Day. I think the association can move on. Mm. But whether the reforms now, whether the, all those reforms, hopefully, we'll never go back to the dark days of say, 3-4 years ago, as early as that. Yeah.
And Mark, finally, the future for John Delaney, like this for him, this story is far from over.
Yeah, like there's an ongoing Office of Director of Corporate Enforcement investigation. It's before the High Court. Gardaí have executed a search warrant on Abbottstown to seize John Delaney's emails. So the investigation is very much focused on what John Delaney did, as well as some other directors, who could be drawn into it. He's got some serious issues to address, serious questions to answer. He didn't engage with the Mazars investigation, and they interviewed most people involved in the FAI and Susan Keegan, his ex-girlfriend. So even the 95,000 euro in payments that went out to her, there's big questions for John Delaney to answer over those. So once that whole discovery process where they're getting access to his emails, John Delaney has to declare which of them he wants to fight, to keep private again, or legally privileged. That's a process that might be for a judge to decide on. But like, there's a serious criminal investigation underway, and we don't know what that will end with.
Well, guys, thanks very much for your time today. The book is Champagne Football: John Delaney and the Betrayal of Irish Football, the Inside Story, by Mark Tighe, Paul Rowan, published by Sandy Cove, Penguin Ireland, and is out now. Guys, thanks so much.
Cheers, Gavin. Pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Gavin.
Yes, thank you very much to the lads, and thanks as always to you for listening and supporting the 42 and this show. It is really greatly appreciated. We're going to be back next week with another great guest, but until then, take it easy.